members of the Commonwealth Club of California, and His Grace Jeffrey Francis Fisher, the Archbishop of Canterbury. This day is notable for two reasons to me and one reason to you. Number one, for you, we have the Archbishop here. And number two, you'll see why it's notable to me. About 8 or 10 years ago, I went to a banquet. We had 20 people there. And the hostess came out with a big birthday cake with a candle on it. And I spoke up brightly and I said, it looks like somebody's birthday. Whose is it? And she said, nobody but your wife's. And since that day, I've never forgotten it. And I looked down. It's the first time I've seen her today because I got up before daybreak this morning. And do you mind, Mr. Archbishop, if I turn to one side and say happy birthday, Doris? Today, I think we must have about 50% Episcopalian share and 25% who come here to ask about Hewlett Johnson and 25% who have come here to find out whether Henry VIII founded the Church of England. This program that came out to you describes our guest today as the Lord, but I asked him, what do they call you when they address you over in England? He said, they call me Your Grace. And I said, why is that? And he says, that's because I rate as a duke, and which means next to the royal family, and it's only the dukes that get called Your Grace. Today, and I think I better tell you exactly how they address him, because they say they're very meticulous about this, and Bishop Pike gave me this, and he said, don't fail to give it exactly. His guest, His Grace, the Most Reverend Archbishop, Lord Fisher of Lambeth, and he says the Lambeth Walk didn't come from the place where he came from, but the Lambeth is the seat of the high prelates of the church. It's been the home of the Archbishop of Canterbury for 1,000 years, and the Lambeth Walk came from outside that place. His Grace has come up through the ranks to the point where it was his hands who crowned the Queen of England. He was first a priest, then he was the headmaster of a well-known school, then he was Bishop of London, the Dean of the Royal Chapels, then Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's the 99th Archbishop of Canterbury. And Bishop Pike told me particularly to mention to you that he's the head of the Anglican Communion, of which our own Episcopalian Church is a part. And he told me also that the Archbishop is the nearest thing to a Pope, which the Episcopalian Church has. And without wasting any more time, I introduce to you Lord Jeffrey Francis Fisher, the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Thank you all. What's the time? Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I might talk at considerable length about some of the things said in introducing me. It'll suffice, perhaps, if I say you'll understand that my friend is a Baptist and therefore has got most of his things just a little bit wrong. I was given very careful instructions about this lunch, and I was told that I should start speaking at 12:47 and was to stop at 1:15. Well, it's already 10 minutes late. Very nearly. I don't know quite what I'm to do, whether I'm to take that off my time for speaking or your time for asking questions. All I will say is this: I'd much rather that the whole time was spent in answering questions. And therefore, I shall do my best to concentrate what I was going to say into the fewest possible words, hoping that somehow I shall stimulate you to want to ask endless questions when I've finished. Where am I going to begin? From Sir Francis Drake. I can't help doing that. As soon as I got into San Francisco, I was taken up to a little service to commemorate the first using of the Book of Common Prayer in San Francisco by Francis Drake's chaplain. Over in New England, I was shown a model of the Golden Hind. And I hope that you still treasure the fact that Francis Drake did come here. What about him? Just this. He crossed the Atlantic in a very little ship and came round into the Pacific in a very little ship. And he came from a very little country, which England still is. And he came at the time of a glorious period of little men doing great things. And if I have a theme at all, it is quality against quantity. The little men have always been the salvation of the world. And Drake and Queen Elizabeth and the rest were little people fighting for their lives against monopolies. Two they broke. One was the monopoly of the Pope of Rome, who gave the New World to Spain. And the other monopoly was Spain itself, who thought that the New World belonged to them. And for good or ill, Drake and his little ships and England with his little resources smashed both those monopolies and thereby released a great flood of exciting, adventurous life in every Englishman, or most of them. If you go back to Elizabethan England, you'll find that in the arts and the literature, Shakespeare and the rest, life flowed because it was the life of simple men who'd found the way to vindicate freedom against monopolies of any kind, spiritual or secular. And they believed intensely in a common effort. And that period was a period of Elizabeth and Drake and the church leaders and the people of England acting as one team. Now, I don't want to go on that theme. You all, I hope, know something of it. And you will understand that it is the background of the whole of English life and explains a great deal. Now I come at once to our own civilization. What about it? I could describe earlier civilizations, yours and mine, as representatives of the biblical story of David versus Goliath. The little man, for David was, against Goliath, the vast man. Our civilization now is disturbed by the fact that everybody is a Goliath. Or if he isn't, he thinks he is. And he behaves like one. And the little men with their weapons of slings and stones are powerless to bring him low. Now that is a very rough description of the civilization in which we live, and I don't believe it is false to it. For whether it be political or economic or any other concern, it is the big business which wins the day. Need I illustrate it any further? I really don't think so. I was just in conversation at lunch, producing one little evidence from my own country, which has no significance, so far as I know, except that it is this question of David and Goliath. We have a great firm called ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, which makes everything beyond chemistry. We also have a firm called Courtaulds, and they're both in the same line of business over nylons and all these fabrics. ICI is a vast concern. Courtaulds is a pretty vast concern, but not as big. ICI decided it wanted to take over Courtaulds and tried to do it by gentle persuasion. And Courtaulds said, no, thank you very much. We want to remain as we are, independent. So then followed all the process of a takeover bid. And ICI said, very well, we'll go to your shareholders and give them so much money for their shares that they'd come over to our side. And they tried and failed. That is the interesting thing. That the shareholders said, thank you, but we'd rather stay where we are in spite of the golden offers of ICI. And still more significant is that the British government did not feel able to say whether it was in favor of one side or the other. It left it to the little men who hold the shares to decide this immense business. I'm bound to add that the staff of Courtaulds wrote to the papers saying, we are the staff of this great concern. We want to remain as we are and not go into ICI. Another lot of little men trying to govern events. And by one way or another, Courtaulds is still independent, and ICI has gone frustrated. Now, I regard that as a good example of a David against a Goliath and David winning. But it's so rare that you'll find very few other examples to quote. And the real trouble nowadays is that nobody can tell which is the David and which is the Goliath. You really can't. I'm not sure it is safe to give examples, but for instance, this at least I could quote, what about Nasser when he seized the Suez Canal? Was he the David or the promising Goliath? He certainly thought he was the promising Goliath. He found it not so easy to be a Goliath as he thought. But there's a great deal which he could have quoted from history and everywhere else to say, I am the David, resisting this imperial power of Great Britain. Well, I only quote that to show you how difficult it may be sometimes to make up your mind which is the David and which is the Goliath. Go into Africa, where we have a very great deal of political problems. Oh, perhaps I better not go as far as that. What about Mississippi? Which is the David? Which is the Goliath? The problem does arise. And in Africa, it's arising constantly. Which is the David in South Africa? And which the Goliath? And you can't answer it as they did in the Old Testament cheerfully by saying, I'll back David every time. Because sometimes David is wrong. And you certainly can't say, I'll back Goliath every time, because he's more likely to be wrong than David. Well, now, there's a vast subject. I can't pursue it. But I do want you to have it in mind, because it takes me a very long time to read the daily newspapers. A very long time. Because almost everything that I read confronts me with this problem. Which in this episode is the David, which is the Goliath? I read only the other day in one of your papers a new little sidelight on the Jew-Arab question. Which are the Davids there and which are the Goliaths? I've been in Palestine. The sorriest sight in the world, to my mind, is the armistice line dividing Jordan from Israel. A barren strip across which these two peoples look at each other, denying the right of the other to exist. And there is no communication between Jew and Arab, Israel and Jordan. I posted a letter in Jordan to a friend in Israel. And my host said, there's no good posting that. I said, why not? He said, there is no post between these two countries. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, this letter will be torn up. Or, at the best, sent to Europe to be sent to the other side of the armistice line. And I could see no kind of breath of a hope which would break through this violent, bitter, hateful armistice line and apartheid. And who was wrong? There's the frightful question. And we in England, who've had a share in this, feel it more bitterly than anybody else. because, as was said commonly in England, we tried to sell the same piece of goods to two different customers. Well, now, I hope I've again made you think. I come back to my real point, that while the world is tied up in this terrible difficulty of deciding where the David is and where the Goliath, in general, people are coming back to believe that as between quantity and quality, it is quality that counts and not quantity. They are coming back to believe it by the very hard way of practical experience. I read just before I left England a paragraph about employers and future managers. And it said that employers had decided that when they appointed their staff, their higher staff, it was not enough to look at their scientific attainments, but that, the exact words were, personal qualities of the candidates cannot be ignored. What an astonishing discovery. But they've just discovered it, only now. And personal qualities cannot be ignored means you've got to go to the little man who's done his duty faithfully and unobserved and got his degrees by hard work, and not merely by the man who's got the highest degree at the end. Now, that well illustrates what I want to say. There are only two forces in the world that I know which are solely devoted, or ought to be solely devoted, to training quality: the churches and the universities. I say that boldly. A few years ago, I couldn't have included the churches because they were much more concerned about fighting themselves, the big against the little, than with quality. But I do want to say to you that in your own lifetime, a miracle has taken place, and that all the churches, the whole lot, without exception, are now devoting themselves to find how better they can combine to produce in individual persons quality. And by quality, they mean the quality of the gospel of Jesus Christ and nothing else. And they're now trying to unburden themselves of the Goliath struggles of the past and to get back to their true work of training quality in separate persons. Because the churches know now that the only people who matter are people and their quality, because they alone qualify for eternal life and the churches don't. And that's a thing worth remembering. If all governments were really governed by the fact that they were never going to get to eternal life, but that each minister was going to have a chance of getting there, it might make a difference to government. But now let me come to schools and universities. The other place in which the real point of the whole process is persons. I've been a schoolmaster. I'm always jeered at as being a mere schoolmaster. And people don't realize that the schoolmaster is devoting his whole energies that the life and work of the school or the university may come to a point in one stupid little boy and train him to be something better than a stupid little boy. That's what we're there for, nothing else. And any school that thinks that it's judged by its sixth form or how many scholarships it gets and so forth has missed the point. And schools do miss the point sometimes. What matters is what they do with the little men, whether they're clever or not, what they make of them. Well, now, again, on this I could talk for a very long time, but let me just read to you one or two words spoken by the chief inspector of schools in Great Britain just before I left England. He said, "The great enemy of education is specialization." Well, I knew that when I was a headmaster in 1914, but they've just discovered it's worth emphasizing. And he says that specialization educates not in depth, but in density. Yes. In facts and dogmas with neither breadth nor depth nor height nor any other creature to recommend it. And he goes on, this modern education disprepares rather than prepares the boys and girls for the real business of university and secular life. Well, now again, I cannot possibly expand that theme, but it is notable, isn't it, that out of the very heart of the educational system comes a word saying, we are somehow missing the boat. We are training specialists without depth, and that means without personal conviction and application. And so I end again with this question of quality. The churches and the schools and universities are, so far as I know, throughout Christendom and throughout the world, the only forces which are trying to train little men to be the best that God will enable them to be. And they alone are delivered from hubris or pride, because as soon as a man begins to think that he's a big man, he's prepared the way for his own fall. It was when mankind got together to build the Tower of Babel to the top of heaven that God said, I really can't have this. And he confounded them by making them all speak different languages. He said, ha ha, that's done them. If they can't talk together, they can't build a tower to heaven. And modern man is so crafty that he got over that one. And the world speaks the same language now of science and economics. And doing that says, now at last we can build the Tower of Babel. Well, against that kind of giantism, there's only one remedy. And that is the remedy of the little men in their little ships, in their little firms, in their little round of duty, devoting themselves with conviction to break every monopoly there is in the service of Almighty God. And there I think I can leave it, only adding this one thing. I've been talking about giants and Goliaths. I understand you have San Francisco giants, and that they're playing a needle game at this very moment. Well, I'm the more honored that any of you should have come to listen to me for 20 minutes speaking to you.
The 17 years that our guest today spent as headmaster of the Repton School were not wasted, because he wound up with degrees from Princeton and Yale and Columbia. And after listening to him, I'm not a bit surprised that he wound up as the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, Your Grace, if you'll just come back to the mic here, we have a few questions that we want to throw at you, and you'll find that they have no inhibitions about asking questions. They ask some rather personal questions sometimes. What did Your Grace and His Holiness talk about when you were at Rome?
I can answer that very simply. We compared our spiritual experiences. And that is the kind of thing that you can't say in public. But I am able to say one thing with the Pope's own consent as to what we talked about. We agreed on a maxim of Thomas a Kempis that if it is a choice between taking more or taking less, the wise Christian thing is to take less.
Now you'll know why I say that they ask some indiscreet questions now and then. Why did the church keep Hewlett Johnson, the Red Dean, in office?
C. Hansard, which is our report of the proceedings in the House of Lords, about 4 years ago when I made a great speech on the subject in the House of Lords. And I said at length what Winston Churchill in the House of Commons at the same time was saying much more briefly. And the answer is simply this. Hewlett Johnson happened to have some very queer ideas of his own. And they caused me and other people and you a great deal of trouble. And at one occasion I said in a public dinner, whenever Hewlett Johnson was at home, I wish he was abroad. And whenever he was abroad, I wish he was at home. But, as Winston Churchill and I both said, he had broken no law, civil or ecclesiastical. And in England, if a man does not break any law, nobody can take any proceedings against him. And therefore, he remained in office. And there are worse things than having an unpleasant or an unsuitable bedfellow to sleep with now and again.
This gentleman, I think, is on the Finance Committee of Trinity Episcopal Church. In the event of a reunion with Rome, what would happen to the ecclesiastical properties?
You're rather tempting me, because a proper answer to this would take me at least half an hour. If I have to shorten it, it is this. If you go back to the New Testament, you will find several different territorial churches, each independent of any control by the other. The Church of Corinth had no control over the Church of Ephesus. The Church of Ephesus no control at all over the Church of Corinth. They were separate churches within the one Catholic Church. If you go to the East, you'll find now the Eastern Orthodox churches. 7 or 8 of them. All territorial churches, and each one of them autonomous, autocephalic, self-governing, but in close relationship to all the others. The Church of Greece, the Church of Cyprus, and I knew something about the Church in Cyprus, the Church of Bulgaria, the Church of all the Russias, each a territorial church, autonomous but related by spiritual bonds to the other churches. That is the New Testament model. It is the earliest model for the church. When reunion comes, I see no reason at all why it should be a reunion of churches under one central headquarters. The apostles didn't give the church any central headquarters. There's never been any acknowledged central headquarters throughout the history of the church. There never will be. But in my belief, the churches, on that basic territorial start, will be autonomous churches in the fullest possible spiritual communion one with another. And if that is the truth, then when we and the Church of Rome are united, it'll be also that we shall be reunited to the Orthodox churches. It'll be a whole family of churches. And no question of property will arise at all, because each of us will keep its own property. And that sounds to me common sense.
I just knew this one was going to bob up. Did Henry VIII establish the Church of England?
Well, I should like to send you back to the Old Testament, when they might have said, did Cyrus deliver the people of Israel? The answer is yes, and God called him. But Cyrus was a pagan. Henry VIII was a Christian. Whether he's a good one or not is not here the question. On the technical point, a difference of theology rose between him and the Pope of the day. And in that purely technical matter, Henry VIII was just as right as the Pope was. But none of this matters. It's all completely irrelevant. For the history of the church, though often affected by secular powers, is never decided by them. Constantine, Julian the Apostate, several emperors of the Holy Roman Empire, several temporal power popes have all affected the church, but have not altered the fact that the church is a divine society. And if you ask, what about the Church of England? It originated, as every other church originates, from the Church of the Apostles, and has come by direct descent from the Church of the Apostles. It came into England through various channels we hardly know, ultimately through Irish and Scottish missionaries who brought it into the north of England, and the church in England was flourishing in the north before it got so flourishing in the south. And when Augustine came from Rome, he pulled together the scattered remains of the British church in the south, but he didn't make any final contact with the church in the north. And it wasn't until later that an understanding was reached between the northern and the southern Christians and the Church of Rome, by which suzerainty passed from the British church to the Roman church. From that point on, the Church of England existed, but under the suzerainty of the Church of Rome. That gave the Church of Rome no divine power of control, nor, when it was freed from that, was it refounded. At the Reformation, the Church of England took back to itself a freedom and liberty which had always belonged to the Orthodox churches, as I've just said, and which inherently belonged to the Church of England too. And the Reformation, quite apart from all the personages in it or all the doctrinal conflicts in it, is simply the record that at a given point in time, the Church of England recaptured the liberty which belonged to it as of right. And that's one of the reasons why I am a firm believer in freedom at all costs, under all circumstances, throughout the world.
Should Protestant and Catholic faith unite under Rome?
Well, I think I've answered that question already. Should they unite? The term Catholic and Protestant are out of date. Or, in other words, they are very dated. They took their rise at the time of the Reformation. And the Protestants have got hold of one end of the stick, and the Romans have got hold of the other end of the stick. And both of them were right and wrong, as people always are when they get hold of ends of sticks. And what they wanted the stick for was to beat each other with. But now, it was in that circumstance that the term Protestant and the term Catholic got their connotation. But the meanings now are all changed. If you use them, you misuse them. I once was landed for an hour at an airport in Lisbon on my way to Africa. And as I walked up and down the airport to get a little air, there was a group of young seminarists of the Church of Rome walking up and down too. And they looked at me and walked on. And the next time they turned around and I turned around, they looked at me rather more closely. And the third time, they began to take off their hats to me. They began to think there was something a bit odd about me, that in some kind of way I belonged to them. And yet they couldn't think I really looked quite as I should. In the end, we stopped and talked to each other. They knew no English, only Latin. I'd forgotten all my Latin. And anyhow, I was never used to talking to schoolboys in Latin of that kind. However, we got into some kind of touch, and they said, "Are you Catholic?" I said, "Yes, but not what you mean by Catholic." They said, "Oh, are you Protestant?" And I said, "Yes, but not what you mean by Protestant." Now what's happening is that we're battling through these old slogans of the past and finding what we really want to say, our common faith. And what has been happening is that Roman Catholics, Anglicans, Orthodox, and the Reformed churches are finding vast areas of faith that they hold in common. Well, now, as we proceed along that line, the old bogies of Protestant and Catholic will disappear. And we shall come together in what will have to be a new form of Catholic, because the word will become no longer synonymous with Catholicism, but with Catholicity. And if you want to have a little exercise, compare and contrast all the words ending in ism with all the words ending in ity. It's very interesting. What about communism and community? What about urbanism and urbanity? What about socialism and sociality? And so you can go on for a long time. And therefore, if you put this question to me, I say, wait a bit, Catholicism as a system is passing, just as Protestantism as a system is passing. And we are coming together in a wider and a better system of Catholicity.
Specifically, what are the greatest advantages of the established church in England as compared to our American separation of church and state?
Well, I can tell you all the disadvantages of your system. But that's not what I'm asked to say. What I'd say about the English system is this. It so happens that the church was going in England before the state was. And the church played a very large part in bringing the nation into being. And once the nation got going, there was the closest possible partnership between the church and the state. And by state, I mean the whole nation, between church and nation. How close, I can explain by saying this, that the church was the only body that trained a civil service. They're the only people who educated anybody. And the state, the nation, the king, the barons, had to depend upon the church because they were the only educated people. Well, now they grew up like that from the very beginning. And as time went on, their proportionate relationships to one another changed. The king, the barons, the church. And in the process of time, the barons got kicked out and the parliament took their places. And so you've got the king, the parliament, and the church in this relationship of partnership, because they're all English. They all belong to one country. They had some kind of common loyalty, and in that loyalty, church and state worked as partners. Well, now, I can't take you through the whole of English history, but what has happened, of course, was that in time, the real power of the king passed to the parliament. And that was odd, because the king was always a head of the church, a churchman, while parliament in time became anybody who believed or anything or disbelieved. And it seemed a bit odd that parliament should still govern, in some sense, the church. In England, if we get to a logical nonsense, we try and look the other way and walk round it, instead of ramming our heads against it. And that is what has happened in this queer situation. Parliament governing the church seemed silly. How did it get right? By Parliament initiating nothing, but simply saying, when you come to us for any more powers, we'll think whether we trust you enough to give them. Well, that's not a bad way. It's what they ought to say to the trade unions, but they don't say it very strongly very often. In principle, there's nothing frightful against that. And in fact, the Church of England until quite recently, was so divided in itself that it couldn't govern itself successfully. And thank God, there was this nominal control by Parliament to stop the church doing anything silly. Now, that's a rather good thing. We've now got to a state, again, thank God, when the Church of England has come itself to such a unity that if tomorrow it was disestablished, it could govern itself with complete ease. That unity in itself. But we still keep this process of going to Parliament because Parliament hasn't yet discovered that we can be trusted. We're educating them to find it out. And as a matter of fact, that education has gone a very long way. We're shortly going to ask for new powers. And I have no doubt that the Parliament will give them at once. Now, why keep this old facade then? The free churches, 50 years ago, were bitterly hostile to the established church. Bitterly hostile. They are now our deep and trusted friends. 50 years ago, they were demanding the disestablishment of the church. Now they're not. They say, in theory, you ought to be disestablished. But the thing is working in such a way that we'd better keep it. And to disestablish the church would divide the nation just when we want to be working together. And so we work together completely happily. And the free churches, finding that we no longer stand on a pedestal above them, but are down with them. The free churches see an advantage in the establishment. We suffer from the limitations imposed upon us, but then we together reap a considerable advantage from the fact that there is an established church, because it gives the whole cause of the Christian faith a better chance of standing as a national force and not merely a sectarian force. Once the sects have come together as they have in loyal trust with the Church of England. And if I want to give you one single example, I had the high privilege of crowning Queen Elizabeth. And that coronation took place in a great ceremony, at the heart of which was the celebration of the Holy Communion. And the Queen received her crown in the middle of the Holy Communion service and herself received the Holy Communion. And the communion service was that of the Church of England. The whole thing was so deeply spiritual that the whole nation was moved by it, and many people out here and elsewhere. And then as I got back into the annex after it was all over, a leading free churchman said to me, "Thank God for the Church of England, for none of us could have done for the nation what you did today." Now, that is an easy example. Imagine if there'd been no established church, what would have happened? Either no religious ceremony at all at the coronation, or a funny service in which the Salvation Army took this bit, and the Baptists took that bit, and the Congregationalists that bit, and Methodists, and we'd come in and take a little bit, and the Roman Catholics would come in and take a little bit, and say, "Hooray, look how united we are." But that kind of dividing a seamless robe isn't unity at all, as it was, because our fellow Christians trust us, our fellow churches work with us in everything. They were able to say, "You do this with our wholehearted consent. For you can do for us and for the nation what no other church can conceivably do." And I give that as the sort of guide to what you might think out as to the advantage of an established church.
His Grace Lord Geoffrey Francis Fisher, Archbishop of Canterbury, retired. The Commonwealth Club of California is very grateful to you for this most interesting address. When you get tired of the fogs of London, come to San Francisco and stay. We have plenty of it here. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California now stands adjourned.